It's one verse. If everyone will stand, I will read the verse to you. And you can leave it that way if you want, because Genesis 4:14, "Behold, thou hast driven me," and that's referring to Cain, "out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth, and it shall come to pass that everyone that findeth me shall slay me." You may be seated. I don't know how long ago it was, a year, maybe 2 years ago, I brought a message on drag queens at the library. I don't know if you can believe this or not. Put it up there, Randa. It's the Chicago Lutheran Church. Lutheran Church host drag queen prayer hour for children. And there's the drag queen. He is a seminary student at the church. Can you believe that? What if Jim and I got up and dressed in drag for the children? Oh my, the country is just gone. St. Luke's Lutheran Church of Logan Square in Chicago. Now, why is it Chicago? We get all these presidents. We get Obama. We get Hillary. We get all these. You know why it's Chicago? Where was the Communist Party founded? Chicago. The Communists. St. Luke's Lutheran Church in Logan Square in Chicago, the communist city of America, hosted a drag queen prayer hour for children recently. Samaritan Aaron Musser, that's Aaron Musser right there, preached in drag to children as part of, quote, "a dress rehearsal for joy." Today we consider what it might be like to have a dress rehearsal for the kind of joy awaiting us on the other side of Advent. Libertation from oppressive laws clears a path for joy. Isn't it so beautiful? Unquote. These poor children probably grow up thinking that perversion is fun, and they will have learned it in church. Well, that's enough of that. In Jim's sermon given on November 14th of this past year, he had the following quote from Josephus, the great ancient historian. And Josephus said, he, referring to Cain, first of all set boundaries about lands. Boundaries. He built a city and fortified it with walls. So he built a walled city. And he compelled his family to come together to it and called the city Enoch after the name of his eldest son Enoch. It's from the Antiquity of the Jews, and I give where it's found. And what became of Cain's descendants? Josephus adds in the same paragraph, quote, "Nay, even while Adam was alive," now he lived for 930 years, "it came to pass that the posterity of Cain became exceedingly wicked, everyone successively dying one after another more wicked than the former." So they got worse and worse. "They were intolerable in war and vehement in robberies. And if anyone were slow to murder people, yet was he bold in his prolific behavior and acting unjustly and doing injury for gain," unquote. Josephus says that Adam and Eve had 33 sons and 23 daughters. Now he lived 930 years. But of Cain he says that, it's in the same paragraph, Cain, quote, "traveled over many countries." I got a question. Who was living in these countries? "He, with his wife, built a city where he also had children. However, he did not accept of his punishment in order to amendment, but to increase his wickedness. For he only aimed to procure everything that was for his own bodily pleasure, though it obliged him to be injurious to his neighbors. He augmented his household substance with much wealth by rapine and violence. He excited his acquaintance to procure pleasures and spoils by robbery, and became a great leader of men into wicked courses. He also introduced a change in that way of simplicity wherein men lived before, and was the author of Measures and Weights. And whereas they lived innocently and generously while they knew nothing of such arts, he changed the world into cunning craftiness, unquote. You can look up Josephus. That's exactly what he says. Why is there a distinction made between the descendants of Cain and the rest of the world? The descendants of Cain, he says, were more wicked, each one after the other. Josephus says that they are the ones who, quote, changed the world into cunning craftiness, unquote. Some of the synonyms for cunning are, quote, devious, scheming, manipulative, deceitful, deceit, shrewdness, devious, trickery, slyness, deception, distinguish, beguiling, etc. This is one of the characteristics that are still true today. They, the descendants of Cain, are masters of deceit. Now, where was Adam and Eve living when Cain built the first city? Did they live in another metropolis? Where did they live? Did they live in a small town? Adam started out living in a self-sufficient garden. The garden was made by their God, and it provided them with all the food that Adam and Eve, and later his wife and children, needed. Genesis chapter 2, verse 8 says, "And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden. And there he put the man whom he had formed." It says the Lord God planted the garden. How did he plant the garden? It doesn't say. Did other non-Adamic people live there? How big a garden was it? There were two distinct family trees that were in the garden. The garden was in the east part of Eden. That these two trees were forbidden to have sexual relations with each other was told in a parable. Right from the beginning, Satan interfered with God's plan and seduced his wife. His son Cain was placed out of where his parents were living and were sent to the land of Nod, which was east of Eden, in modern-day India, after he murdered Adam and Eve's son Abel. Later, after his expulsion, Cain feared for his life. Why did he say that everyone that finds him would slay him if there was no one else in the world? And who did he build the walled city for? If there's no one else in the world, why did he need a wall for protection? And it wouldn't be called a city if just one family was living there. It was the pre-Adamites who had joined them and were living there. Was the first city built in direct defiance of God's command that he should wander the earth as a drifter the rest of his life? Why would Cain have built a city anyway? Because he no longer could be a farmer. That was part of his curse, too. And if you think about it for a little while, you can see how awful this curse would be. You could go from being a farmer to a person that could not grow any produce. How would Cain and his descendants get the food that they would need if they couldn't farm? Genesis chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. And now art thou, referring to Cain, cursed from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive thy brother's, referring to Abel, blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond thou shalt be in the earth. Whoa. A fugitive and a vagabond. Cain and his descendants could no longer be farmers. They would be fugitives and vagabonds. Does anyone know of a people that are called vagabonds in the New Testament? Would these be the descendants of the same vagabonds in Genesis chapter 4, verse 12? It's Acts chapter 19, verse 13, part A, where it says, "Then certain of the vagabond Jews," which should be Judeans, it goes on, "these vagabond Judeans or Edomite Jews were extortionists who failed in their attempt to get rid of a demon. But they could not grow their own food. So in order to eat, they had to become either exorcists, merchants, traders, casino operators, lobbyists, money producers, abortionists, film producers, actors or actresses, money changers, bankers, realtors, priests, so forth, so they could buy or be given their food." This is a big handicap. They cannot produce their own food supply. What was Adam's descendants' main job? They were sheep herders and farmers. They were to live on their self-sufficient farms. They could produce their own food. I received a clue on this when my immediate family went to visit Souder Village in Archibald in northwest Ohio this past fall. At this tourist village, one of the residential guides recalled the story of some of the early settlers of the territory. She said that they needed very little money or no money at all in order to live. We can't do that today. We must have Federal Reserve notes or digital numbers in our checking account or credit cards in order to function in the city. I don't know what we could do without them. We too must buy our own food. But the tourist agent emphasized that they needed something else besides money when they came to live on their self-sufficient farms. When they arrived in the black swampland of Ohio, most of the immigrants had no money. But they had to have at least a few sheep, a few chickens, and a few horses and some fertile land in which to settle. Young children from the age of 3 were taught to stretch out the wool from the sheep to make threads for their clothes. One of the first things they had to do was have a water source for their animals and themselves. They used the wool from the sheep to make their own clothes. They used the eggs from the chickens to use in many of their recipes. And they used the horses to help them plow the ground and pull up the trees. They had to grow their own food. They had to rely on God for the correct weather and for protection against the crop-destroying animals. And then they had to preserve the food in containers and store them in a cool place. After doing all these necessities, they then had to choose another activity to help the family. Either they could be a weaver, or a pottery maker, or a barrel maker, or a bottle maker, or a machinist, or a barber, or a baker, or who knows what. Whatever it was, they could trade what they made with their neighbors for what they needed. It took no money or very little money in order to live and have wealth. And the more children that they had, the more they could do. Most of these settlers in northwestern Ohio came from Germany, Switzerland, and the Scandinavian lands. Many of the early settlers were Amish, but later converted to be Mennonites. They were descendants of Adam and Eve. They were also descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They didn't live in cities. They lived in rural lands. They were farmers with cottage industries. They were good neighbors who helped one another. What happened? Well, what happened in America? Before the war between the Union and the Confederate States of America, 1861 to 1865, the South didn't have any large cities, while the North did. Why was that? Let's look at an article that was written by Richard Hoskins, which he called Cities, which was taken from Briar Hedges and Indians, 2007. It begins, and I'm quoting from Richard Hoskins' article. Virginia was once virtually off limits to the international merchant. The reason was obvious. There was little the international merchant offered that Virginia wanted. Virginia had numerous towns, but no real cities. Before the war, and I put in between the two countries, North and South, Lynchburg had 4,000 year-round residents. Richmond had 20,000, and Norfolk had 30,000. Most everyone lived on their own self-sufficient farms and produced their own wealth. They had ample free time to develop their own cottage industry, whose products satisfied their own needs and the needs of their neighbors. With few exceptions, the goods of the international merchant were neither needed nor wanted. Buena Vista. Buena Vista is up the river from Lynchburg, just over the Blue Ridge, where the James River forks. Before the war, it contained a warehouse and a few houses. Canal boats coming up the James with cargo destined for the other fork would store its cargo in the Buena Vista warehouse until it was picked up by a boat going up the other fork. Now, let's look at this. Here's Buena Vista, this green star. Here's Virginia, Virginia Beach, Richmond, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia. I, referring to Richard Hoskins, used to drive through Buena Vista in the 1940s. It was strange looking. It had lampposts in the middle of pastures with cows grazing around them. There were two impressive three- or four-story red brick city office buildings, lone sentinels standing in otherwise vacant city blocks. A little way out of town on the way to Natural Bridge was a big deserted hotel in a wheat field on a low hill. One wing was finished, and another wing was partly finished. There were a few houses scattered about. Planned cities. Buena Vista was a planned city or a promoted city, one that wasn't successful. After the war, the victors changed Virginia's laws, and cartel promoters freely bought land, gained a charter, and built a city to attract people to work the nearby mines, which had produced low-grade ore for over 100 years. However, the mines played out, and the promoters left Buena Vista only partly finished to build elsewhere. Its skeleton was left to amaze passerbys. Overnight cities. Big Lick was a winner. The promoters bought railroad yards and repair shops and changed this name to Roanoke. In Lynchburg, the first thing that they did was to build the First National Bank. The cornerstone reads 1865. Next, they built cotton mills and a steel mill, and Lynchburg began to grow. It grew from 4,000 to 50,000 by the time I was a boy and is now 70,000 or there whereabouts. The question often asked is, why did Virginians want the international merchants after the war when they wanted almost nothing to do with them before the war? Replacing the farm. The traditional self-sufficient farm provided wealth, food, increased herds and considerable free time for their cottage industry to fashion tools, make machines, operate blast furnaces, weave cloth, make harnesses and wagons, and countless other items. Every creek had its mill. When we went to Gatlinburg, you went down, was it Cave Cove? There's a little stream, and they had a mill. Everyone put their wheat and took it to the mill. Most of the wealth created by their cottage industry was exchanged for the things they did not have. It produced far more wealth than the city system of the North. It provided most of the exports and far more than half the country's tariff income, which was spent mostly in the urban North. It also provided work and substance for growing families and care for the aged. The Albemarle County Poorhouse had two rooms and stood vacant most of the time. There was little need for money or cities in Virginia. The self-sufficient farm system did everything else and did it better before the war. Exchanging commodities. The exchange of commodities most often took place at the Crossroads Country Store. The store owner charged one item out of 10 for disposing of the rest of the consignment. What was not sold was returned to the creator of the wealth along with the admonition to better manage his efforts in the future. Millers charged one bushel of wheat out of each 10 they ground the flour. Sometimes there were several stores specializing in different items. These groupings were usually located at a crossroads. This was called a town. Money was seldom used. Good times arrived with good weather, not with the boom and bust market economy of the city. Virginia was completely unaware of the depression that ravaged Pennsylvania and much of the North in the 1850s. The self-sufficient farm system is God's natural wealth-creating system and is insulated from the vagaries of Esau's market economy. The life of the untaxed farmers was vastly different from the lives of people living in the city system. Europeans experienced the last of their self-sufficient farms with the arrivals of Charlemagne's empire in the 800s. It was my good fortune to have grown up in the ruins of such a farm system. It's a shame that the ongoing conquest of the West requires its destruction. And then Richard Hoskin talks about wars. There were many attempts to destroy Virginia's farm kingdoms and seize and make merchandise of the people and their land. Following is a proclamation of one of Lincoln's generals. Quote, in 1862, General Pope was appointed to command the Federal Army of Virginia. He made a speech to his army to the effect that he did not approve of this protecting the property of the rebels, and that he intended that his army should subsist, that is, live on the country through which they passed. And he gives the book and the page and has a footnote number 1. Federal armies pillaged and plundered their way through the southern states for the duration of the war, and Lincoln supported several confiscation bills that allow them to plunder private property as they went, and gives a quote from the other book. He also quotes, "Lincoln championed the leaders of the European revelations of 1848. 1848 was the year that Marx wrote his book. This was official authorization to steal, loot, rape, and murder. It came from the top. Only recently has the population of Amherst County across the James from Lynchburg grown larger than it was in 1864 to 1865, when it was swollen by the flood of refugees fleeing the barbarous Union armies. These refugees felt it was better to live in the woods under lean-tos, half-starved in the freezing snow, than to live in their own houses behind Union lines and suffer the atrocities inflicted by the invaders. Missouri was left a depopulated wasteland. My great-great-grandfather watched Lincoln overseeing Union soldiers systematically destroying the Kelly barns and the flocks at Kelly's Fords. The depredations were not accidental. They were done according to plan. The purpose was to stamp out the self-sufficient farm system and replace it with the market economy of the international merchant, the city. Then I had to add the following. Note that this last sentence is in bold type and highlighted in yellow. This is the most important thing to remember about the war. What was the purpose of the destruction of the South? Why did the North have the desire to destroy the farms and plantations of the South by destroying their livelihood? It was to destroy the self-sufficient farm system and replace it with the market economy of the international merchant, the city. Lee's 20,000 men unconditionally surrendered to Grant's 200,000 men at Appomattox. They removed the last armed resistance in Virginia. Then he talks about the Reconstruction. Immediately, the divided Southland was reconstructed so that it be properly incorporated in the city. The next sentence says, disarmed. Southern whites were deprived of the vote which was given to blacks. Blacks were also given rule over the whites. That's the first time in the United States history that happened. Governors, senators, congressmen, city council, state legislature, police, militia were black. All this took place under the protection of the federal occupation bayonets. All this is against biblical law. What is now happening in South Africa is a carbon copy of what the blacks did to the American Southland. Under direction Republican, Jewish, carpetbaggers, black legislators voted themselves enormous salaries and taxed farmland to pay for them. Tariffs were placed on formerly cheap imports, so the farm implements became expensive. Differential freight rates made it more costly to ship goods by rail from Richmond to New York than from New York to Richmond. These rates weren't removed until the 1950s. All this was carefully planned. Virginia's farm produced food and articles from cottage industries, but they did not grow money. Taxes had to be paid in cash. There was no cash. Farms went on the auction block for whatever land would bring. Land companies owning millions of acres were the only ones bidding. Land at Kelly's Ford, valued at $850 an acre in 1858, sold at 50 cents an acre in 1900. Gives a footnote number two. He talks about Mr. Miller Noble of Lynchburg sold 14,000 acres of his family land near Richmond for $7,000 as late as 1952 to avoid taxes. Government policy made the produce of the land bring less than the taxes demanded. The war between the states was fought to remove the South's self-sufficient farm system and replace both it and its law system with the international trade cartel's city. It was a complete success. Cheap food from domestic and foreign corporate farms undersold the few farms that survived. Stripped of their land and having no way to support their families, jobless, landless refugees flocked to Lynchburg seeking work. Cartel planters had prepared for this, and the town was ready to receive them. When I was growing up in Virginia's countryside, it was a land of deserted farmhouses and deserted country churches whose cemeteries dated back more than 200 years. The hundreds who had attended them had gone. The cartel-built rickety company housing along with the ambiguous company store. Then they moved their New England mill operations to Lynchburg, where labor was cheap and plentiful. Destitute Virginians stood in line for a chance to labor 15 hours a day for a pittance to keep their families from starving. The Southern farmer, perhaps a bit more roughly treated, was now equally a slave with his northern kinsmen who hadn't a clue as to what was taking place or why. Mm-hmm. Protocol. Henry Fornes, the Dearborn Independent and exposed to the protocols, chose to highlight land. Here is its summary pertaining to protocol number 6. Here's what it says. The farmer's strong advantage is that owning the land, he is independent in his sources of livelihood. The land will feed him whether he pleases international financiers or not. His position is impregnable as long as the sun shines and the seasons roll, unquote. War against the independent farmer. For almost 1,000 years, Britain had been a January agent of the international trade cartel. During the ongoing Indian hostilities against American Saxon settlers, the British government often sided with the Indians against their own flesh and blood, furnishing leaders and equipment for Indian war parties who raped and murdered old and young, male and female. The Indian incentive was to kill the white man as a religious offering to their god Oki, who ate pain. They offered captured members of neighboring tribes or even their own children when offerings were scarce. The British government used the Indian customs for their own ends, which was to destroy the independent farms and prevent inevitable opposition to the city empire. Now here's a quote. In 1817, Creeks who had joined the Seminoles in Florida incited them to war. General Jackson was sent against them and seized St. Mars in 1818. Two British subjects, Ambrister and Arbuthnot, were captured at that time. Jackson knew these types and, like Lew Wetzel, was not squeamish about killing them. On the charge they encouraged the Indians to kill whites, he executed them as renegades. It's from his book, Vigilantes of Christendom, page 125. As a footnote number 3, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel, 1 Kings 12:24. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, Leviticus 19:18. During the Revolutionary War, the Crown sent its armies into the Carolinas and Virginia where they burned farms. In the War of 1812, the British landed on Virginia's northern neck and again burned and destroyed farms. They captured slaves and sold them into the Caribbean. The destruction of the independent farm system is necessary if the cartel city system is to exist in their place. In 1861, the Union Army lived off the land. It was part of their plan. There are great stretches of the American Southland with almost no farm buildings standing dating prior to 1861 to mark where self-sufficient farms and their nearby trading villages once stood. In 1899 to 1902, the British Empire's scorched earth policy destroyed South Africa's self-sufficient farms. slaying vast herds, and confining survivors in concentration camps where they died like flies. After that, South African cities grew like mushrooms. The city spreads worldwide. In 1924, Russia's self-sufficient farms were collectivized, and 5 million farmers were starved. Cities like Moscow immediately began to spread over the countryside. After the German collapse in World War II, the Eastern German farming region was given to Polish communists to collectivize. A large number of the 9 million Germans who died after the war died during their expulsion from their ancestral lands. The United States, the pretended ally of nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, withheld war material and allowed Mao to conquer all of China. Mao promptly collectivized ancient family holdings and imprisoned or executed millions of landowners. Today, China's cities are unable to hold a great number of farm refugees, and the Chinese government is in the process of building 40 new cities to house and better police this potentially explosive force. In 1985, a great farm rally was held in Nebraska, protesting bank foreclosures and mass corporate farming. Esau's media universally condemned the gathering, and puppet politicians ignored their plight. The rally failed, and the last of America's independent farms have almost disappeared from the land. America's cities continue to experience a housing building boom from the displacement of populations. The path of destruction. The Hindu is the world's international trader. In theory, Hindus accept all gods as different manifestations of their own god. Hindus seldom call themselves Hindu, preferring to use the name of local gods to help business. The common denominator is their obedience to the ancient beliefs and laws. Called by different names, the ruling Hindu god of this age is Kali, goddess of death. She is the destroyer. Hindus believe that this is her age, the age of Kundalini, and will end when all life ends, once the white devils who stand in her way and hinder her progress are removed. Her spirit, many millennia old, is alive and well, and the success of her march is told many ways in the Hindu Puranas. Internet search reveals the same story told and retold many ways, but with the same basic predictions. A brief synopsis follows. Apocalypse for the Hindu is the natural ending of the world in the fourth age, the Kali Age. Vishnu will appear again as Kakai, a winged white horse. She is destined to destroy the present world and take humanity in a different, higher plane. All kings occupying the earth in the Kali Age will be prone to take the paltry possessions of others, having character that is mostly vile, rising to power and soon falling. They will be short-lived, ambitious, of little value, virtue, and greedy. People will follow their customs of others and be adulterated with them. Peculiar, undisciplined barbarians will be vigorously supported by rulers. People will commit sin in mind, speech, and action. Quarrels, plague, fatal diseases, famine, drought, and calamities appear. In the Kali Age, there will be many false religionists. People will freely commit abortion. Earth will be valued only for her mineral treasures. Money alone will confer nobility. Power will be the sole definition of virtue. Praiseworthiness will be measured by accumulated wealth. Simply to be well-dressed signifies propriety. The pretense of greatness will be the proof of it, and powerful men with many severe faults will rule over the classes on earth. People will suffer from cold, wind, heat, and rain. Thus, in the Kali Age, humankind will be utterly destroyed. The results. There is nothing supernatural about seeing this ancient prophecy unfold before our eyes. Esau's cartel believes it to be inevitable. Since they believed to be inevitable, they used their enormous wealth gained through their usury banking system, hoarded in their great international corporations, and administered by their merchant managers and puppet kings to bring it to pass precisely as written many thousands of years ago. The wars, famines, and sufferings come about because they are ordained by their God. They fully expect the evil they do to result in good. These Hindu prophecies are heard over and over, mantra-like. They have the wealth and power to make them self-fulfilling. But before their ultimate victory, the white devils, standing in the way of Kala's victory, must die. To hasten their destruction, the habitat must be destroyed, the self-sufficient farm. The city, Esau's trap. Today's city is Esau's refuge for those he has made homeless and destitute. With their homes destroyed, the city is the only haven remaining, a haven which is also a prison. In the city, one must depend on the cartel for his livelihood. One's wealth is no longer God-given from the land. Man must now obtain Esau's magic money to pay for his bread, shelter, tax tribute, medicine, and retirement. He must even attain a permit to conduct business. Esau's media monopoly tells him what to think, and rebels are quickly hounded into silence, killed, fired, fined, or imprisoned. Scrimping and saving, retirement hospital bills reduce many to becoming beggars overnight. And he has footnote number 4, where he says, my wife recently spent a week in the hospital, $30,000 for the doctor and $32,000 total, $64,000. We had good insurance, but many don't. Above all, he is required to be tolerant of other gods and obedient to their laws, even when it means disobeying God, the Word. Killer stress. It is stressful for a racehorse to pull a plow. It is stressful for a little Pekingese dog to herd cattle. City life is stressful to the Saxon. The city system generates worry and stress and drastically reduces the Saxon's birth rate, which now stands at 1.6, far below the required 2.1 children per family needed to maintain status quo. On the other hand, Esau thrives in his cities, as he should. It is his habitat. In spite of television, new houses, and football, Jacob does not prosper in Esau's city. It is alien to him. That is why Esau and his agents destroyed Jacob's habitat and forced him into the city. Esau plans to destroy his hated brother, so he will disappear from the earth and allow Kali's day to arrive. The other road. Unfortunately for Esau. Unfortunately for Esau, when he makes war with Jacob, he makes war with Jacob's God. The scriptures say that in the beginning, the world was made by him, John 1:10. God made the world and assigned ownership. The earth he has given to the children of Adam, Psalm 115:16. He then directed how it's to be ruled. The land shall be divided, Numbers 26:55. Finally, the land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, Leviticus 25:23. Esau and his puppets have forced Jacob from his land and have taken and sold it like a pair of shoes. God said he wanted his people to live alone. Esau and his puppet rulers and priests have brought a flood of Esau's children to take Jacob's land and eat up his substance. These unlawful invaders are breaking God's law and trespassing on God's land. But this too is prophesied. For Esau is the end of the world, and Jacob is the beginning of it that followeth, 2 Ezra 6:9. The time is late. God's word is eternal. The following will come to pass as is written. The eternal God is thy refuge, and he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, Destroy them. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine. Also as heaven shall drop down dew. Deuteronomy 33:27-28. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will give unto God a place there of graves in Israel. Ezekiel 39:11. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. Deuteronomy 33:28. And that ends Richard Hoskins' article. I quoted Richard Hoskins' article in its entirety because it gives a unique look at a great biblical truth. It answered the questions of why General Sherman marched throughout the countryside of the defeated South, destroying and burning farm after farm, and why this period at the end of the war was so vicious. And it has been kept mostly quiet, just like who was behind the destruction of Germany after World War II. It's the age-old story of the war between Cain and the family of God. And one of the main reasons for these wars is that Cain and his descendants can no longer farm. That was one of his curses that he received from our God. God's family was to have set their own self-sufficient farms. Farms that could produce enough food for the family, plus producing goods that could be changed for other goods from other family farms. And many of these farmers didn't have much money, or they had no money at all, but they had much wealth. I've always wondered how my mother, who grew up in a family of 12, was able to survive. The answer was, they lived on a farm. And there was always some work to do. But they had very little money. But they had plenty to eat. That's how they did it. They followed this much of God's law. The self-sufficient farms had to cease. Much of the former plantation owners had to live in the city. The former farmers had to make usury loans. They had to use cash, preferably usury cash. But there's still one people living on our land that didn't fall for Esau's trap. They still have their self-sufficient farms. They don't have much money, but they have much wealth. They have many cottage industries. They remain separate from the world. They help each other. Too bad their theology has gotten so bad. But they can take credit where credit is due. They are the Amish. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel,